Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Aubrey Kazemi will be telling us a little bit about adaptive ballet. So, can you tell me a little bit about adaptive ballet?
So adaptive ballet is really just making ballet accessible for all, and it's not really even ballet per se, but those principles of self-expression. We do work on technique as well, but it's really more about another outlet to express oneself, another outlet to gain some control and mastery, and also just to promote overall health. So we do a lot of stretching, strength exercise, work on coordination, stuff like that. So, yeah, it really encompasses a wide range of things.
So how do you go about reaching out to the disability population to let them know about your work? So, how do you go about reaching out to people with disabilities to let them know about the work you're doing?
Okay. So the studio really handles a lot of the promotion aspect. We reach out to the local children's hospitals and other local programming throughout in the neighborhood. But really, it's listed on the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's website, which is a very resource that a lot of people use, obviously. And then I think through word of mouth is also big. And then in this local school system, people hear about it. But this program, it's been running for a while now. I've just been teaching for the last 2 years. But it is also nice. It's this specific class I taught other classes, but it's really formed a nice community over the years because a lot of the girls have been in there since the program started. So that's really nice. So from school or different work events, they'll also tell people about it. I think promotion through organizations such as children's hospitals and facilities like that have really been beneficial.
So do you use any modified equipment or techniques in the work you're doing, in the performance?
So, I'm a trained and a professional ballet dancer, so I like to, they're there for ballet, so I like to give as authentic and a real experience as it would be. So, I mean, we use the ballet bars, and those are great. Also, just, and everybody uses those just to ascertain balance and to really gain mastery of those steps before we move to center work. Then it's really just their bodies. Something I will use is sometimes props or arms to kind of, it just helps them more creatively and authentically think about how to use the arms and coordinate them in with movements. We recently, my class performed in the Nutcracker, the studio's Nutcracker, and they did the Waltz of the Flowers. So for that, they actually held, we practiced with softer flowers, but they actually held dried flower stems, which was really beautiful. And so I think by working in props like that, they're just kind of nice ways to, about, I would call it, improv. it's carriage of the arms and the head. So just really nice ways to bring in and integrate and find new and creative ways to use our upper body and our arms and that expressive, those expressive qualities while we're doing more, more difficult steps with our legs. But other than that, not too much equipment goes in into the class, really just trying to use their own bodies and with everything's like body weight, strength exercise, and stuff like that.
So, what types of disabilities do you most commonly have to adapt for?
So, right now, the class is primarily individuals with Down syndrome. There are a few with cerebral palsy. And it's shifted throughout the years. But that's about what I see. But I definitely make adaptations in terms of developmental level. And keeping in mind all of that, something from one of my students, seizures might be an issue, so I have to look out for that and making sure of placement in the room. But really, not too much adaptations in terms of other than that. Sorry, that answered the question.
Yep, absolutely. So, in your time with Accessible Performance Arts, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I'm trying to think. There's so many. I mean, I don't know. I'm a big believer in just finding things in the little things. And I don't know. I think really every class I get those like big success feelings when like somebody's able to... like another thing we work on is a lot of like fast movements and like quick impulses, more like reflex movement based. And so last class, one of my students just really excelled in that. I saw her really being able to go into her big soda shower jump straight from her preparation and her entrance. So that was really big. So I don't know, those little milestones that I just see week to week. And I mean, that is with ballet, there's so much repetition and practice and going back to the same steps and movements every week that does allow for you to really see that small progression time after time. But yeah, I don't know, just those little moments of just gaining a little mastery over step or jumping a little higher on a leap, those definitely stand out to me. I'm trying to think about big moments, recently watching them perform on the stage in front of the Nutcracker. That was a really incredible moment. Just to see, I've been working in the studio with them for so long, but just to be able to see them on stage and to really take that performance aspect was really amazing. I'm sorry, you might have muted really fast one second. Sorry about that. Just want to get rid of the background noise.
It's okay. I'm editing later anyway.
Okay. But yeah, I think getting to see them have that performance opportunity and be on stage, that was just a really incredible moment, seeing their faces, realizing on stage, and hearing the audience's response. There was just so much joy there, so that was that really stands out. I think of any other, I think of another big one I'll throw it out there.
So, if you could send any message about the need for inclusion in the arts, what would you say?
Oh, well, it's tough to bring it down to one message, but I think there needs to be, there's definitely a desire for these programs, and I think often people, I think more than ever, there's a place for them to be included and to be more visible. And I think I really applaud Studio Ballet for allowing them to be in the performance. But yeah, I just think, I think dance really is meaningful for all in terms of self-expression and in terms of mastery over the body. And so I think it should be available to all. And I think that also starts with major organizations making their performances accessible so that people can see these art forms and know that they can do them and perform in them, and B, that there are places for them to pursue this. So I know some companies are starting to open up, professional ballet companies are starting to open up sensory-friendly performances, and I really think that's, I really applaud that. I think that's a good way to go, but yeah, I think just there needs to be more visibility and access, and I think that starts with just introducing people to the art.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, of course.
This segment of our show, Doug Earle will be telling us a little bit about Fighting Blindness Canada. So, can you tell me a little bit about Fighting Blindness?
Sure. So, Fighting Blindness Canada was formed by a group of parents coming together because their children had been diagnosed with an inherited blinding eye disease. And at the time, in 1974, they didn't know what the biology was. They didn't understand how the genes worked and what role it had to play. And there was no treatments. So that basically the doctor told them that their child was going to go blind and to go home and get the child ready. So as a mom and dad, you know, obviously that wasn't good enough. And so they wanted to fight, and they wanted to invest in research in order to develop treatments that could prevent blindness in their child or and their family loved one, or to restore their sight. And that's, so Fighting Blindness Canada is Canada's largest funder of vision research. Over $40 million has been invested, and we've helped play a role in developing the two treatments that are preventing blindness and in one case, restoring sight.
So, how do you go about reaching out to researchers in the medical community to let them know about your work and what might be available to them?
Yeah, so we have a well-developed network with Canadian and international vision researchers. We invest first off in career grants. So we have a clinician scientist emerging leader award that targets residents, whether they be in ophthalmology or in optometry, and encourages them to, while they're being trained to become an eye doctor, that and they have that interest in understanding developing research. So what they see in the clinic, they go off to the lab to figure out why, and once they understand why, that becomes the target for treatment. So we've developed this training ground. We help people launch their careers, 30, 40-year research careers, while they're also practicing clinically. And secondly, we offer a series of research grants. So some of them are targeted initiatives, like Restore Vision 2020, where we're removing the final barriers to getting into clinical trial, a discovery, in this case, stem cells. Or we offer an annual competition. This year, we awarded 8 grants to inspire researchers to answer a question, get that data they need to apply to a larger grant from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. So we broadly broadcast it through the Academic Research Network, and you know, we unfortunately, in some ways, unfortunately, we had 43 applicants for this round. We were only able to fund 8.
So, when you mentioned barriers for getting into clinical trials, could you elaborate a little more on that? What might hold a person back?
Well, we created, Fighting Blindness Canada created the first inherited retinal disease patient registry. So one of the largest, and the reason we did that is because one of the most significant barriers to clinical trials is finding participants to be involved. So there's lots of privacy in health. You know, the networks between doctors aren't as strong as you would hope. So that's why we started back in 2004, the first registry in the world. And it's proven over and over again as a way of breaking down that barrier. So, for example, the first gene therapy approved for treatment in any human is an eye disease treatment for RPE65. Five members of our registry went to Philadelphia to participate in a safety trial, phase one clinical trial, who had that gene. And a part of why it was five Canadians was because we had this registry to make it easy to connect people with the condition who could qualify for the criteria of the clinical trial and to be able to participate. So those five Canadians, it's now 12 years later, they're in one eye, it's stabilized. They've been able to maintain their sight. In their other eye, the disease has progressed. So in many cases, there's not many photoreceptors left, or there's just enough that now that the treatment's been approved, Luxturna, it could benefit to save what little sight's left. For us, Fighting Blindness Canada is working hard to make sure that those clinical trials are in Canada so that we don't have the barrier of crossing the border, especially during this pandemic period. So we've made two key investments, one in Montreal, where because of our investment, we leveraged a whole bunch of infrastructure that was in place. So we went that clinic in Montreal went from three now to almost a dozen clinical trials active at this time. We just made an investment to help the recruitment back of a Canadian from Harvard to set up through the University of Toronto and the University Health Network, Kensington Health, to create. So he had an interest in doing clinical trials. So we helped make it possible for him to come back. And he's busy. He's setting up his clinic. He's setting up his lab. And we hope to launch. He'll be launching some clinical trials shortly. So that way, Canadians closer to home can get access to these trials.
So in your time with Fighting Blindness, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Absolutely. First off, we've doubled our research funding compared to when I started 3 years ago, and that's because of the generosity of Canadians stepping up, especially during this pandemic, to support vision research moving forward. We have a very significant investment in stem cells. We just announced in December the second phase funding. That researcher, because of our investment, because the three donors made a commitment of $2.5 million, we were able to fund four projects. And now this second phase, we chose the winner, the one that's closest to getting into clinical trial. And with our first investment and the success of those experiments, he's been able to access a path to access about $100 million of private sector investment. So if our experiments that we in phase one and two are successful, he has a milestone that he can pass and continue to access his funding through the clinical trial process. So that's just been amazing. Like that's exactly what the program was designed to do, to do the final experiments that would get this product into this treatment into clinic, into human. And we're so excited that this, our goals of our program are showing great promise.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. Can I just add one more thing?
Certainly.
While you're recording, of course, yes. If anyone is interested in finding out more about our research, please visit fightingblindness.ca. That's fightingblindness.ca. Thank you.
Thank you very much. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Aubrey Kazemi told us a little bit about adaptive dance, and we heard from Doug Earle about Fighting Blindness Canada. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Wendy Fralick from the Center for Individuals with Physical Challenges. So, what can you tell me about the center?
So, the Center for Individuals with Physical Challenges is the place where we are committed to providing opportunities for people with physical challenges to enhance the quality of their lives. So we are a 75,000 square foot adaptive recreational facility where we offer adaptive sports, fitness options, recreational options, youth programming, and just an amazing space for people to come and be a part of rather than be excluded from.
So how do you go about reaching out to the disability population to let them know that your programs exist?
That is such a great question, Cameron. That is something that we are challenged with all of the time. Our best ways of getting new people here are from our current members. They meet someone, they're in the disability community, they are letting them know about the center, they're inviting them here, and then those people end up joining us. That's certainly the best way we get new members. We also work very closely with colleges and universities to bring youth in here that are going to be going into practices like PT and OT, and they can then make recommendations here. We advertise our services to rehabilitation outlets throughout Tulsa so that they can refer their people here. And then our youth program coordinator goes to schools, and she educates the teachers, the parents, and youth with physical challenges about what we offer.
So it's interesting you bring up about education. Do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning what's possible for someone with a disability?
You know, I think that the biggest obstacle our youth see are what other youth think, right? So that they are less than, or that they cannot achieve something that their quote-unquote abled peer can attain. And I think that that's not true, and we see it all the time here. We have our youth program, they do rock climbing here at the center. We have a rock climbing wall. I mean, where would that be possible for them elsewhere? But the fact that they're able to do it, and they're able to put their little name up on the wall, seeing how high they get. I mean, it's amazing what our youth can do. And the fact that because you have a physical challenge doesn't mean you have a developmental disability, right? And I think that's a big challenge they face in their lives as well. They think that they're not smart. And that just isn't the case. These are extremely smart kids that will one day be our next doctors and lawyers.
So, in that sense, when they're out there doing something like rock climbing or being a part of a team, I've always found that people with disabilities are just kind of living in the moment when they're engaged in the exhilaration of sport or some sort of group activity. It's not about what could hold them back. It's about just being a part of the moment. You ever find that to be the case?
1,000,000%, Cameron. We have a youth member here right now, and this would go, anyone would say this here, but one of the youth members said that, "I feel like when I'm at the center, I'm a part of and I'm not excluded." And I think that's the most important thing that we bring to the lives of the people that we serve, is that you are a part of. And there are a lot of opportunities for you to participate in, and we want you to participate in those opportunities. Absolutely, that thrill of being part of a team and achieving victory together is an amazing experience that everyone should have access to.
So, what are some of the most common adaptations for sports and recreation that you find?
So obviously wheelchairs, right? So we have sport wheelchairs for our friends who are already in a wheelchair, but also our members who are not in a wheelchair but could not run bases, for instance, in softball. So we have the equipment for them to be able to play softball. We have power soccer chairs. We have the basketball, wheelchair basketball chairs. In terms of adaptations throughout the building, our fitness center is fully adapted, right? So we have cardiovascular equipment, but you can move the chair out of the way so that someone in a wheelchair can roll right up and use the equipment. We have hooks that go on hands so people can do the pull-down bar or do the chest bar if they don't actually have use of their hands. The varieties of things that we have here make it possible to be able to experience a full workout and participate fully in recreational activities that just might not be possible someplace else.
So, in your time with the center, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Absolutely. So, like most other places, we closed when COVID arrived. So, we closed in March 2020. I had arrived in June 2020 and was given the task of reopening. That was the number one task, get the center reopened. So we reopened with a very comprehensive plan in place in July 2020. And a member of ours, Erin, she came back with her mom. And her mom said, you know, I just have to tell you how hard it's been with the center closed over these past few months. Erin's health has waned incredibly. Erin was a college student. She played volleyball in college. She went on to graduate and then became a volleyball coach for her college. And then she had a stroke. And she's had multiple strokes since that first stroke. And when she came back to the center in July, she was in a wheelchair. And again, we're talking about a young lady. So she came back, she was in a wheelchair, her mother expressed, you know, what it had meant to her daughter to not be here. And when she came back, not only was she attending fitness classes and going to the fitness center, but she was trying to work on her walking. And she started by doing a few steps a day away from her chair. She would sit in her fitness chair, she would get up, she'd do a few steps, she'd walk back to her chair. Within a couple of months, she was walking to half and back in our gym. And a couple months after that, she was walking the full length of the court and back with no cane, no wheelchair, no walker. And it took a while, and we all knew it took a while, but she was so focused on accomplishing that. And to this day, she continues to walk the halls, and we continue to support her and cheer her on, just as every other member does. And it's just one of the stories that I get to walk through the halls and see every time I see her, and it just is so humbling, and I'm so grateful for what we're able to offer that family.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. My friends, disability performance art has a great potential, I think. The potential to open doors to new audiences and new levels of understanding for those who might not necessarily be as familiar with disability life. If you can present these matters to them in a performance way, something enjoyable, maybe even something relatable, the question isn't what did they have to adapt or how is this better than or not as good as any other performance. They won't be thinking of it from that mindset at all. Fact is, it is not better or worse. It's merely an adaptation. The question becomes in their mind, was it something worth seeing? Did it reach my heart? The answer is yes. You may find the audience would be asking questions. Is this really how it plays out in day-to-day life? How can I make this better? What sort of supports would I need if I were in this situation? Fact is, giving it a human face gives it a real-life story. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.